Ladies and gentlemen, we have landed at Johannesburg Airport. We will be here for a long time, perhaps days, even weeks. All our patience will be tried, so I must warn you that any disobedience will be most severely dealt with. Already one attempt at resistance has been made, and in consequence a member of the crew has been shot and gravely wounded. He may die of this wound. We do not want a repetition of this incident. However, I must again warn you that my officers and I will not hesitate to shoot again, or even to detonate the explosives above your heads, if the need arises." She paused and watched a moment as two selected doctors came forward and knelt on each side of the flight engineer. He was shaking like a fever victim with shock, his white shirt splashed and daubed with blood. Her expression showed no remorse, no real concern, and her voice was calm and light as she went on. "Two of my officers will now pass down the aisles, and they will collect your passports from you. Please have these documents ready." Her eyes flicked sideways, as movement caught her eye. From beyond the service hangars, a line of four armoured cars emerged in line ahead. They were the locally manufactured version of the French Panhard, with heavily lugged tall tyres, a raked turret, and the disproportionately long barrels of the cannons trained forward. The armoured vehicles circled cautiously and parked 300 yards out, at the four points, wingtips, tail and nose, around the aircraft, with the long cannon trained upon her. The girl watched them disdainfully, until one of the doctors pushed himself in front of her. He was a short, chubby little man, balding but brave. "This man must be taken to hospital immediately." "That is out of the question. I insist, his life is in danger." "All our lives are in danger, doctor." She paused and let that make its effect. "Draw up a list of your requirements. I will see that you get them." They have been down for 16 hours now, and the only contact has been a request for medical supplies and for a power link up to the electrical mains. Kingston Parker had removed his jacket and loosened the knot of his tie, but was showing no other ill effects of his vigil. Peter Stride nodded at the image on the screen. "What have your medics made of the supplies?" he asked. "Looks like a gunshot casualty. Whole blood type AB positive. That's rare, but one of the crew is cross-matched AB positive on his service record. 10 liters of plasmalite B, a blood-giving set and syringes, morphine and intravenous penicillin, tetanus toxoid, all the equipment needed to treat massive physical trauma." "And they're on mains power?" Peter asked. "Yes. 400 people would have suffocated by now without the air conditioning. The airport authority has laid a cable and plugged it into the external socket. All the aircraft support system, even the galley heating, will be fully functional. So we will be able to throw the switch on them at any time." Peter made a note on the pad in front of him. "But no demands yet. No negotiator called for." "Nope, nothing. They seem fully aware of the techniques of bargaining in this type of situation. Unlike our friends, the host country. I'm afraid we're having a great deal of trouble with the Wyatt Earp mentality." Parker paused. I'm sorry, Wyatt Earp was one of our frontier marshals. I saw the movie and read the book," Peter answered tartly. "Well, the South Africans are itching to storm the aircraft. Both our ambassador and yours are hard-pressed to restrain them. They're all set to kick the doors of the saloon open and rush in with 6 guns blazing. They must also have seen the movie." Peter felt the crawl of horror down his spine. "That would be a certain disaster," he said quickly. "These people are running a tight operation." "You don't have to convince me," Parker agreed. "What is your flying time to Jan Smuts now?" "We crossed the Zambezi River 7 minutes ago." Peter glanced sideways through the Perspex bubble window, but the ground was obscured by haze and cumulus cloud. "We have another 2 hours 10 minutes to fly, but my support section is 3 hours 40 behind us." "All right, Peter, I will get back onto them. The South African government has convened a full cabinet meeting, and both our ambassadors are sitting in as observers and advisers. I think I am going to be obliged to tell them about the existence of Atlas." He paused a moment. "Here at last we are seeing Atlas justified, Peter. A single unit cutting across all national considerations, able to act swiftly and independently. I think you should know that I have already obtained the agreement of the President and of your Prime Minister to condition Delta, at my discretion. Condition Delta was the kill decision. But again, I emphasise that I will implement Delta only as a last possible resort. I want to hear and consider the demands first, and in that respect, we are open to negotiation. Fully open. Parker went on speaking, and Peter Stride shifted slightly, dropping his chin into the cup of his hand to hide his irritation. They were into an area of dispute now, and once again Peter had to voice disagreement. Every time you let a militant walk away from a strike, you immediately create the conditions for further strikes to free the captive. I have the clearance for Condition Delta, Parker reiterated, with a trace of acid in his tone now, but I am making it clear that it will be used only with the greatest discretion. We are not an assassination unit, General Stride. Parker nodded to an assistant off-screen. I'm going through to the South Africans now to explain Atlas. The image receded into darkness. Peter Stride leapt up abruptly and tried to pace the narrow aisle between the seats, but there was insufficient headroom for his tall frame, and he flung himself angrily into the seat again. Kingston Parker stood up from his communications desk in the outer office of his suite in the west wing of the Pentagon. The two communications technicians scurried out of his way, and his personal secretary opened the door to his inner office. He moved with peculiar grace for such a large man, and there was no excess weight on his frame, his big heavy bones lean of flesh. His clothes were of fine cloth, well cut, the best that Fifth Avenue could offer, but they were worn almost to the point of shoddiness, the button-down collar slightly frayed, the Italian shoes scuffed at the toes, as though material trappings counted not at all with him. Nevertheless, he wore them with a certain unconscious panache, and he looked 10 years younger than his 53, only a few silver strands in the thick, bushy mane of hair. The inner office was Spartan in its furnishings, all of it U.S. government issue, utilitarian and impersonal. Only the books that filled every shelf and the grand piano were his own. The piano was a Bechstein grand and much too large for the room. Parker ran his right hand lightly across the keyboard as he passed it, but he went on to the desk. He dropped into the swivel chair and shuffled through the dozen intelligence folders on his desk. Each of them contained the latest computer printouts that he had requested. There were personal histories, appraisals, and character studies of all the personalities that had so far become involved in the taking of Speedbird 070. Both the ambassadors, their pink files signified the highest security ratings and were marked heads of departments only. Four other files in lower echelon green were devoted to the South African government personalities with decision-making capabilities in the emergency. The thickest file was that of the South African Prime Minister, and once again Parker noted wryly that the man had been imprisoned by the pro-British government of General Jan Smuts during World War II as a militant opponent of his country's involvement in that war. He wondered just how much sympathy he would have for other militants now. There were files for the South African Ministers of Defence and of Justice, and still slimmer green files for the Commissioner of Police and for the Assistant Commissioner, who had been given the on-site responsibility of handling the emergency. Of them all, only the Prime Minister emerged as a distinct personality, a powerful bulldog figure, not a man easily influenced or dissuaded, and instinctively Kingston Parker recognised that ultimate authority rested here. There was one other pink file at the bottom of the considerable stack, so well handled that the cardboard cover was splitting at the hinge. The original printout in this file had been requisitioned 2 years previously, with quarterly updates since that time. Stride, Peter Charles, it was headed, and reclassified, Head of Atlas only. Kingston Parker could probably have recited its contents by heart, but he untied the ribbons now and opened it in his lap. Puffing deliberately at his pipe, he began to turn slowly through the loose pages. There were the bare bones of the subject's life. Born 1939, one of twin wartime babies of a military family. His father killed in action 3 years later when the armoured brigade of guards he commanded was overrun by one of Erwin Rommel's devastating drives across the deserts of North Africa. The elder twin brother had inherited the baronetcy, and Peter followed the well-travelled family course, Harrow and Sandhurst, where he must have disconcerted the family by his academic brilliance and his reluctance to participate in team sports, preferring the loner activities of golf and tennis and long-distance running. Kingston Parker pondered that a moment. They were pointers to the man's character that had disconcerted him as well. Parker had the intellectual's generalised contempt for the military, and he would have preferred a man who conformed more closely to his ideal of the brass-headed soldier. Yet when the young Stride had entered his father's regiment, it seemed that the exceptional intelligence had been diverted into conventional channels, and the preference for independent thought and action held in check, if not put aside completely, until his regiment was sent to Cyprus at the height of the unrest in that country. Within a week of arrival, the young Stride had been seconded, with his commanding officer's enthusiastic approval, to Central Army Intelligence. Perhaps the commanding officer had already become aware of the problems involved in harbouring a wonder boy in the tradition-bound portals of his officer's mess. For once, the military had made a logical, if not an outright brilliant, choice. Stride, in the 16 years since then, had not made a single mistake, apart from the marriage, which had ended in divorce within 2 years. Had he remained with his regiment, that might have affected his career. But since Cyprus, Stride's progress had been as unconventional and meteoric as his brain. In a dozen different and difficult assignments since then, he had honed his gifts and developed new talents. Rising against the trend of reduced British expenditure on defence, he had reached staff rank before 30 years of age. At NATO headquarters, he had made powerful friends and admirers on both sides of the Atlantic, and at the end of his 3-year term in Brussels, he had been promoted Major General and been transferred to head British intelligence in Ireland, bringing his own particular dedication and flair to the job. A great deal of the credit for containing the sweep of Irish terrorism through Britain was his, and his in-depth study of the urban guerrilla and the mind of the militant, although classified departmentally, was probably the definitive work on the subject. The Atlas concept was first proposed in this study, and so it was that Stride had been on the shortlist to head the project. It seemed certain the appointment would be made. The Americans had been impressed with his study, and his friends from NATO had not forgotten him. His appointment was approved in principle. Then at the last moment, there had developed sudden and intense opposition to the appointment of a professional soldier to head such a sensitive agency. The opposition had come from both Whitehall and Washington simultaneously, and had prevailed. Kingston Parker knocked out his pipe and carried the file across the room and laid it open on the music rack of the piano. He seated himself at the keyboard and, still studying the printout sheets, began to play. The stream of music, the lovely ethereal strains of Liszt, did not interrupt his thoughts but seemed to buoy them brightly upwards. Parker had not wanted Stride, had considered from the very first that he was dangerous, sensing in him ambitions and motivations which would be difficult to control. Parker would have preferred his own nominees, Tanner, who now commanded the Mercury arm of Atlas, or Colin Noble, and had expected that Stride would have declined a command so far below his capability. However, Stride had accepted the lesser appointment and headed Thor. Parker suspected that there was unusual motivation in this, and had made every effort to study the man at first hand. On 5 separate occasions he had ordered Stride to Washington, and focused upon him the full strength of his charisma and personality. He had even invited him to stay with him in his New York home, spending many hours with him in deep, far-ranging discussions, from which he had developed a prudent respect for the man's mind, but had been able to reach no firm conclusions as to his future in Atlas.